Welcome to Middlebrow, where big ideas undergo the digital martyrdom. This is John Mark Reynolds coming to you from Scriptorium Daily, the Torrey Honors Institute and Biola University, discussing big ideas and putting them through the digital martyrdom. Today, we're going to do what we like to do periodically, though it's hard to do things periodically on a show that we've done, five, six times. But I'm here with my colleagues as usual, Fred Sanders and Paul Spears, part of the leadership team, really the associate directors in an informal kind of way of the Torrey Honors Institute here at Biola, discussing our big book. We're going to put Plato and his dialogue, The Phaedrus, through the digital martyrdom. Now, before all you geeky people write in and tell me I should say Phaedrus, Fred Sanders will say,
we got these Greek books through Latin authors, and so we changed their pronunciation. Phaedrus is how you say it in English.
Yes, and so
which English? Because our British colleagues say it differently.
Yeah, if we start down the road of the British, who refuse to pronounce French words like French
Kant.
Words and say filet mignon instead of filet mignon.
Or Kant and Kant.
Yeah, I've heard very clever Englishmen say, let's go get a filet mignon, which when I was a young boy in the South was drilled out of me lest I sound like a young boy from the South. It's a very strange world we live in. Anyway, we're going to put this hugely important Platonic dialogue through the Middlebrow kind of, hey, let's walk through this dialogue way too quickly, and here's what we think of it, digital martyrdom. Why does the dialogue matter? Well, first of all, I think one advantage for those of you who've been not connected to Torrey for a while is that the Torrey curriculum is done two different ways. The first way it's done is chronologically. We read through all authors in chronological order, the way they appeared in history. There are real advantages to that. The other way we do it is by idea or topic, and we move through topics in a sort of natural order, from very foundational topics to more senior year type topics, more ending topics, from beginning to end. And one good thing about the second way of going through Plato is that we've been able to read more of his texts in, I think, a more interesting manner in some ways, because Plato deals with everything. Like the Bible, though not inerrant and not nearly as important to us as Christians, Plato deals with everything under the sun. A little bit of theory of knowledge, epistemology, a little cosmology, a little bit about origins, a little bit about science, every topic, ethics, he deals with it. So he's a real good compendium, one-stop shop. And Phaedrus is if you were in the first way of doing Torrey chronologically, one of the most important Torrey dialogue or Plato dialogues you didn't read in Torrey. And the reason for this is it's one of his everything I've ever thought about I'm going to put in one place dialogues. And it's done in some of the most clever literary manner ways that Plato ever uses. It's set up very nicely as a dialogue between Phaedrus and Socrates about a speech that the young man has heard, and it's done in the country. Why it's done in the country is, in fact, an interesting question about the dialogue. It culminates in one of Plato's best literary myths or imaginative works, the two horses analogy for the soul. In fact, if you're ever going to say anything about Plato, you have to have read the Phaedrus, because people who talk about Plato will often come back to this picture of the bad horse and the good horse and the charioteer, who, by the way, is often forgotten even by scholars who write about this dialogue, as an image of the human soul. In fact, it's such an important image to me as a person that Keith Buehler, a graduate of Torrey Honors, actually did a pencil sketch, and I have it hanging right in here in my office to remind me both of some of the lessons of the dialogue and of Keith, who's a good friend, and I appreciate him a lot. So that's the dialogue in a nutshell. I haven't told you anything about it other than that it's important, and if you haven't read it, you should. What are we going to talk about? Well, we don't know yet. So let me pose the first question, which weirdly, Plato doesn't always open with a question, but he does in this dialogue. He begins by saying, my dear Phaedrus, where have we been and where are we going? Whence and whither? One translator puts it, and if it were better English, better modern English, where did you come from and where are you going? I should be more precise because it's not a we. But in the Greek, it's really a whence, whither kind of question. And that's a beautiful way to start this dialogue. What does it make you guys think of? Fred Sanders and Paul Spears, this is John Mark Reynolds for Middlebrow.
Well, that opening question helps you focus on the fact that Plato's not just a philosopher. He's also a, I was going to say a novelist. He's a novelist isn't right, dramatist isn't right, but he really invests heavily in the story setting that he puts these dialogues into. I think a lot of people have read badly written philosophical dialogues where it's just a way of having two different points of view interact. Plato's got something richer going on than that. So you have to start asking, who is Phaedrus and why is Socrates, now Socrates the character, talking to Phaedrus the character, where literally at the level of story is Phaedrus coming from? And as Socrates and Phaedrus talk, it turns out that, well, what Phaedrus says is he was just listening to a speech by Lysias, this great orator, and he thought it was really interesting and wondered what Socrates would think about it. Now, there's some question and answering there, and it turns out that Phaedrus actually is carrying the speech and was just looking for someone to read it to and talk to about it.
I think the other thing, Paul Spears, that this brings to mind is geography. It doesn't often occur. By the end of the Republic, for example, though a geographical setting has been made very carefully at the beginning of the Republic, Tory students might remember long discussions about going down to the Piraeus and why that matters. By the end of the Republic, it's as if everything is focused down on Socrates and Glaucon. If you were staging it, the stage would have gone dark with a spotlight only on those two men, one young man and one older man, sitting deciding about eternity in a mythic world that's come to surround them. Right away in Phaedrus, we're reminded of geography and the fact that Socrates is in the country where he's not normally found. Anything just about Plato in general, Paul, that this brings to mind, this focus on geography?
Well, it's always interesting because I think he intentionally is getting you to think about placement as idea. In other words, if you're in the country, what are the kind of thoughts that you're having if you're in the city? Are you thinking about the democracy? Are you thinking about the Republic itself? In the symposium, they start with him separated from the party that's about to happen, standing on the next-door neighbor's front porch, which I think intentionally is to get you to think, oh, he's not really with this group of people. He's going to this gathering, but he's really not a part of this gathering. And he's sort of looking off into the distance, thinking about other things rather than what they're thinking about in the now. And I think that you see the same kind of thing here. By being in the countryside, he's sort of distanced himself from the sort of hoi polloi, the goings-on, the hustle and bustle of the city.
You know, when we read, we've entered into a kind of virtual reality. So virtual reality isn't new. In fact, it's the most still, I think, effective virtual reality machine that exists. If you're a good reader, I can be pulled into a Trollope novel. It's what I'm reading right now for fun. In a much deeper way than most video games, all video games I've ever played. They're still not very well made in that way in terms of total immersion. Is Plato, I think he is, reminding us of placement, but he's doing it in a virtual world. They're not really in the country. We're not really in the country. We're not really there. How can we be someplace when we're not someplace? What's going on with that, where we're in the country but we're not in the country? Where we're listening to Socrates, but we're not listening to Socrates. Socrates is long dead by the time this dialogue was written. He never said any of this.
I wanted to ask, you're someone who's read all the Plato repeatedly. Is this the only going outside of Athens dialogue?
No, it happens at least one other time off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very rare for Socrates to be outside the city and outside the city voluntarily. I don't think... Again, this is quickly because you asked me a question.
Yeah.
I remember really getting a plausible reason for why Socrates is outside of the city in this dialogue. In every other case, for example, the Republic, he's obviously outside the city to go down the city proper. He's outside the walls, walking down to the Piraeus. In one other dialogue, he's walking someplace and they're engaging in things or he's resting. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of scenes where he's in battle outside the city, at least verbally, as he describes things, like in the symposium. But here, it's not clear at all why he's left the city.
Because in all the other cases, he's in Athens talking about Athenian things, talking about life together, talking about things we'd call politics broadly.
It's safe to say in the vast majority of situations in all the dialogues, like 90-some%, this is exactly right.
He was put to death for political reasons, and he walked around doing political talk
all
the time.
He won't leave, see Phaedo, the city, even at the cost of death, because he says the Socrates gig, the thing I do, can't be done in any other place other than inside the city of Athens. Mm-hmm. So to see Socrates just out for his health, I mean, what's he doing out here is very bizarre.
And he talks about it. This is not a side issue in Phaedrus. He's talking about it constantly. He says things like, I usually don't go out here because you can't really learn anything from trees and meadows. You learn from people.
That's right. And of course, there's a big emphasis, and Al Geyer, who's kind of my guru on this kind of topic, makes a strong point about the tree that he's sitting under, because right. The dialogue makes a strong point about the tree and the mythic kind of setting. Big things happen mythically in this spot. Now, if somebody's listening to this and they're not wanting to be a Plato scholar, why is this emphasis on place in virtual reality important? Does it have anything to say about us? Are there any immediate thoughts about that? How can we be someplace virtually, and why should we care? Why does anyone care about any of this?
Sometimes it does seem like one of the things that I notice is that it's getting distance from the thing that you're thinking about, because they're actually still thinking about the speech, but they're not in the middle of the city. And this gives them an opportunity to, I think the word that they use is, it's more refreshing, right, to walk outside in the country. So you're not sort of pushed and pulled in the same way that you would be, especially somebody like Socrates, who is well known and probably stopped often inside yes. of the city and yes. engaged in different moments of the dialogue, where he is actually able to concentrate on something without all of that pressure, yet think about the things that he thinks are most important.
Yeah, often the dialogue taking place in a temple, which is actually a very busy place, or the marketplace, the Agora, famously, mm-hmm. Inside of Athens, very loud, and lots of non-philosophical, in our modern sense, things going on there.
So it matters a lot. It's a bit of a retreat. I mean, they're going out to this beautiful setting, and they see, oh, we're walking by a creek, and we see a tree. I think my reading of Phaedrus is the reason they have to go on a retreat of some kind or get outside of city life is that young Phaedrus, though he says he's just read this interesting speech, and isn't it clever and ironic, and, oh, guess what Lysias said? You should actually give yourself to people who don't love you instead of people who love you. Isn't that witty? I mean, what a clever speech that is to say non-lovers are better than lovers. What do you think about that, Socrates? I haven't read the dialogue closely enough to know who's steering who here exactly, but
right.
It emerges that I think that Phaedrus is actually entertaining this proposition, and he's not just reading some clever speech that made things appear one way. He's actually making a decision about whether to follow a non-lover or a lover.
Yeah. I think that's right, and I will say that I believe he believes he's playing Socrates, but that Socrates demonstrates he knows all along that, you know, what game is. It's hard to out Socrates.
Right.
And so Socrates ends up steering the conversation, though teaching in his typically indirect way, mm-hmm. Phaedrus, what's wrong with the speech of Lysias? You know, why is this bad?
So you hear the whole speech of Lysias, and then you hear Socrates' whole deconstruction of it. And for young Phaedrus, it always seems like, oh, this is an academic exercise. But in fact, his future is at stake, and Socrates has taken him on a little retreat to get his head together.
Well, yeah, I think that's right.
It also seems like in the dialogue, I think at first, isn't Phaedrus trying to recapitulate the speech on his own, even
yes.
though he has it underneath
in
his garment?
Pocket,
and he's like, let me tell you this speech. And he goes, do you have the speech on you? And finally, he sort of fesses up and says yes. And I think one of the tensions that's going on there, too, is our own memory and our own attempts to recapitulate things often skews the thing that they are, and then the critique of them is not what it needs to be. And so he's got these, if you're right, Fred, you know, that he's got these decisions that he's making, but these decisions are often made from his bad reconstruction of an argument. And I think by Plato pulling him into, no, let's go to the text, as it were,
right.
This is going to force him to really understand the nature of the discussion that they're falling into.
Yeah, I tried to be really careful early on in this discussion. I kind of made it sound like it was a we at the beginning of the dialogue. And I think it's important to note that unlike the Republic, where even though they're a little separate, Glaucon and Socrates begin the dialogue at least physically together. They're going the same place and then they're coming back from that place. Whereas in this case, Phaedrus really is on his own. with the speech of Lysias. They have to, oh, come along with me, I believe is an important line here in the beginning, and I'll teach you, Socrates. I'll tell you about this. And they agree to this. I think we have here the picture, and this is common in our culture, of the bright young man with great potential being led by a bad teacher and not being near the good teacher. In fact, he's outside the city where he has no chance normally of meeting Socrates. And then like a miracle, Socrates is there because he's needed. And it's this opening miracle, but also the danger of the bright young man. If you're a Tory student, you know that we often think about Alcibiades as the bright young man who appears in many Platonic dialogues, appears in Thucydides, you know, lots of ancient documents center around this bright young man who goes bad because he has bad ethical teachers who twist his mind. And we certainly see a lot of that in the state of California.
You just described Phaedrus as being in danger being outside the city.
Yes.
He's all alone out there in the wilderness with a speech, an evil speech by Lysias in his pocket.
Yeah, even in ancient Greece, even near Athens, outside the city is a marginal place, right? Civilizations inside the city, shepherds don't have the status they have for the Jews because shepherds are kind of between, right? They're between wilderness dwellers who are barbarians and city dwellers. And so shepherds, they can be good, but they're also scary things happen to them. Gods appear, bad things happen. And even the
robbers.
Place, yeah, even the place they sit is a place where gods did bad things to people. It's near there anyway. Mm-hmm. What's the significance of that? The mythological reverberations of the dialogue.
I think that's a great conversation. It's really short. I wish that Plato had done a little more with it. It's very suggestive, though. Phaedrus and Socrates have a little conversation about, oh, I think this is the rock where – I won't get the gods' names right. Do you remember? Where the wind god blew so-and-so off, tried to rape her, and she fell into the sea or fell into the creek. And then Phaedrus says – yeah, but I heard at my liberal seminary that none of that really happened.
it was that's just great. Boreas. It's what I wanted to say, but I quickly looked it up. And
the god was Boreas.
Yeah.
And so he really presents a pretty standard demythologizing take on this Greek myth. Well, it didn't really happen. It wasn't a god. It was just a strong wind, and it blew this lady off, and then superstitious people made up this legend.
As someone who takes the biblical stories as straightforward history, it always amuses me when people explain things to me very, you know, in the 19th century, people realized some stories could be taken mythologically. And I feel like screaming and saying, yes, or I could have read Phaedrus and seen this same tact taken in 450 or 400 BC. You know, this is not new under the sun.
And actually, Socrates' main answer to that is, yeah, the demythologizing account you just gave could have happened. But if you're going to do that, you're going to have to explain every myth that way. And that's going to become a really tiresome conversation.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And I think it's the sort of tiresome conversation you often have with Homer, where somebody says, why did people believe things like that? And they invent little pseudo-psychological explanations for where stories come from. And I think the first couple of times you do that, that's a lot of fun. And then it becomes dull.
It's as dull in 411 BC as it was in paperback theology from the 1960s.
What's amazing to me is even post-Tory, we'll run into students who somehow discover it as if we've hidden this way of reading text from them. And you feel like saying, no, please. If you would just say something new and interesting, that would be good. Eventually, we get to these two horses. One horse is, I'm not fond with this kind of imagery, dark. And quarrelsome, and the other is bright and light and submissive, but both horses are necessary to the soul. Any quick reactions to this most famous myth from this most important of Platonic dialogues?
One of the first things I was taught when I became a Christian is that I've got two dogs inside my inner man, and I need to starve the bad one and feed the good one.
Not like Quine's two dogmas of empiricism and since, different kinds of
and
dogs.
And since that's not directly in Scripture, I'm wondering if my youth leader got it from Plato.
Yeah, I doubt it. But as fond as I am of seeing Plato,
but it is that bad reading that you take of that, right, where you just make them diametrically opposed, and you're saying that they're sort of the yin and yang going after each other.
Yeah, I don't think – I mean, Plato's often read as denigrating the body or denigrating the erotic nature, and yet he never shows you getting rid of, like, killing. You should leap out of your chariot as the charioteer and kill the dark horse and just have one horse and things would go better. No, it's the dark horse that provides a lot of the energy for getting the chariot. The white horse is kind of too placid, too docile. And so Plato's not that way. Certainly, we as biblical Christians should never look down on the body or the erotic nature, whatever Plato's view is. Is there this side of paradise redemption for this dark horse, this erotic nature that's constantly tugging us the other way? I don't think so. I think that that kind of perfection isn't coming this side of paradise. Plato certainly didn't believe it was ever possible. This is a defect in Plato. Any quick reactions to that?
No, my answer is the boring one, that it all depends on how you define the role played by that dark horse.
Please,
if it's embodiment or physicality, then there will be redemption in the resurrection. But if it's sin, or if you're trying to say, well, everyone needs to be a little bit bad if they're going to really be good, then I'd say, no, that's another form of the lie of the devil.
Yeah, as funny as that sounds, that is actually a common lie of the devil. One sees it in something like Star Trek, the original series, where Kirk is repetitively split in half. There are at least two episodes that I can think of. And what they discover is, I need my bad half. It's right. My bad half that motivates me. Plato never says that. And I think the Bible certainly never says that. You don't need wickedness. What you need is drive or energy.
Right, but it's often equated with aggressiveness, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I love to eat. I love to eat food. As a result, I've struggled with overweight all my life. Eventually, what Plato or the Bible would say is, I need to bring this thing into right order. The Bible tells me how. Plato just says, I need to do it, and doesn't tell me how. In fact, kind of throws up his hands and says, hey, most of you, no hope for you. Forget about it. But you do need to bring it into order. But nobody ever says you should quit eating or only breathe air or do philosophy. So, Phaedrus, any final thoughts on this dialogue? You kind of go around the circle and say, all right, we've sent everybody out to read this dialogue. They get to the end of it. What do you think is some takeaway value for you, Fred Sanders, for a Wheatstone student? Who one of our favorite programs, reading Phaedrus with us this summer.
I think there are two things that the dialogue might be about, love, eros, or rhetoric. And I think the only way to solve what is Phaedrus ultimately about is to say it's actually about both of those. It's about the role of love and desire in persuasive speech. Right? It's a really important dialogue in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is just the fact that it's easy to be swept away by something persuasive like that. And the fact that, as you pointed out, John Mark, that sort of miraculously Socrates appears and saves a lad from destruction,
yes,
is an important part for us to remember. Is that in this society that sort of crafts itself in such a way that things tickle our ears, we need to be very aware of that and look to not take things as we first see them.
Well, I the thing that I end up with is that Phaedrus reminds us why Tori is not a great books program and never should be, and no one should ever send their kids to a great books program. Because at the end of Phaedrus, Plato reminds us that a book is a kind of virtual reality, and real education is very dangerous when it's taking place, like it was for Phaedrus, only in the context of virtual reality. Hmm. You need a real teacher, a master teacher located in a physical space and time, helping a young man or a young woman see the face of God. Phaedrus ends in a prayer, so I end in a prayer by saying, Lord Jesus Christ, as teachers, have mercy on us and help our students to see your face in everything we do or say. This is John Mark Reynolds for Middlebrow, a service of Scriptorium Daily, where big ideas, in this case the Phaedrus, have undergone the digital martyrdom.